All right, get ready to dive deep into celiac disease with us today.
A topic you're bound to encounter on the SCE exam.
Exactly. We'll be covering the essentials, from the pathophysiology and how it actually presents, to the trickier parts of diagnosis and management, those little details that might trip you up on exam day.
And we can't forget those visuals. Got to make sure you have a good grasp of those, too. Got to be ready for anything the SCE throws your way, right?
Exactly. Okay, so celiac disease. It's an autoimmune disorder, and we know gluten is the trigger, but what's actually happening there? Can you walk us through that?
It's really interesting the way the genetics and immune system are working together here.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got these genes, HLA, DQ2, or DQ8, and if you have them, you're predisposed to celiac.
Right.
Now, when someone eats gluten, the peptides from wheat, barley, or rye, they get into the small intestine and they go through this process called deamidation, all thanks to this enzyme called tissue transglutaminase, or TTG.
TTG. Okay. So that's a key player.
Absolutely. Key player. These modified peptides then bind to those HLA molecules we talked about, and that sets off this whole inflammatory cascade in the small intestine.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, T-cell activation, all these cytokines released, and eventually damage to the intestinal villi. You know, those structures that are crucial for absorbing nutrients.
And that damage, that's what leads to the classic GI symptoms we see with celiac, right?
Exactly. Diarrhea, weight loss, bloating, the statorrhea, they're all common.
Yeah.
But, and here's where the SCE exam can get a little tricky, they love to test you on those symptoms that go beyond the gut, those extra intestinal manifestations.
Okay, so we need to be thinking systemically.
You got it.
So what are some of those less obvious things we should be looking out for?
Well, iron deficiency anemia is a big one.
Okay.
Often comes with fatigue, of course. And then you might see osteopenia or even osteoporosis because of the problems with calcium absorption.
Interesting.
And then there's dermatitis herpetiformis. Sometimes this one gets overlooked.
Dermatitis. Herpetiformis. Now that sounds more like dermatology than GI.
It is a skin condition, but it's directly related to celiac. It's a really itchy, blistering rash. Can be pretty awful for patients.
I bet.
For the SCE, you really want to be able to recognize it. The images they provide in your study material are great for that.
So we're really talking about a disease that affects multiple systems with lots of ways it can present. What else should we keep on our radar?
Well, neurological symptoms, they're not as common, but they can happen. You might see ataxia, which affects balance and coordination, and peripheral neuropathy.
Okay, so numbness and tingling in the extremities.
Right. Those are some things to keep in mind. And to make it even more interesting, remember that celiac disease is often linked to other autoimmune conditions.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Type 1 diabetes, autoimmune thyroid disease, even selective IgA deficiency. They're all more common in folks with celiac. The SCE exam, they love these multi-system scenarios.
It sounds like we need a systematic approach to diagnosing celiac disease.
Definitely.
So where do we even start?
Serological testing is the first step. The anti-TTG IgA test, that TTG we talked about earlier, that's highly sensitive and specific for celiac.
Okay.
Anti-endomasial antibodies, or EMA-IgA, those are helpful too.
You mentioned earlier about checking total IgA levels. Why is that so important, especially for the SCE?
Because IgA deficiency is more common in patients with celiac, and if someone has that deficiency, those serological tests can be falsely negative.
I see.
You could miss the diagnosis completely. Classic SCE trap.
Definitely something to remember. Okay, so let's say serology comes back positive. What's next?
Then we go for the gold standard, a duodenal biopsy.
Okay.
But here's the thing. For the exam, they want to make sure you understand the right technique.
Oh, fine.
You need at least 4 samples, and they need to be from both the bulb and the distal duodenum.
Why is that level of detail so important for the biopsy?
Because the disease might not be evenly spread out in the small intestine.
Right.
So taking multiple biopsies increases the chances of seeing those characteristic changes, and that helps us classify the disease.
Okay, which brings us to the Marsh-Oberhuber classification.
Yep.
The Marsh stages. I remember those from med school.
Ah, good times.
But is there a way to understand them beyond just memorizing?
Absolutely. Think of each stage as a snapshot of how celiac disease progresses. Each stage shows a different point in the inflammatory process happening in the small intestine.
Okay, I like that.
Yeah.
Walk me through that progression, the story of the Marsh stages.
All right, so we start with stage 0. It might seem weird, but the mucosa can look totally normal, even if the serology is positive.
So it's like potential celiac disease.
Exactly, like a ticking time bomb. Great for differential diagnosis on the SCE.
I bet.
Then you've got stage one, where you see more intraepithelial lymphocytes, or IELs. More than 30 per 100 enterocytes is a sign the immune system is reacting.
So the body's starting to fight back,
yeah.
But the damage isn't severe yet.
Right. Then in stage two, you get crypt hyperplasia, which means the crypts are deeper than normal. The inflammation is definitely active, but you don't see villous atrophy yet.
Getting closer to that characteristic damage, though.
Exactly. And then stages 3A, 3B, and 3C, that's where you start to see the villous atrophy.
Ah.
Partial, then subtotal, then total villous atrophy. The worse the atrophy, the more malabsorption you get and the more obvious the symptoms are.
So the MARSH stages really help us visualize how the disease develops and how it might affect the patient.
Absolutely. And speaking of understanding the disease process, we need to talk about refractory celiac disease, or RCD.
Oh, okay.
This is where things can get really tricky, both for treating patients and for the SCE exam.
Refractory celiac disease. That sounds pretty serious. What does it mean exactly?
So it's when the symptoms and the villous atrophy, they just don't go away, even after the patient has been strictly gluten-free for at least 12 months.
Wow, so even cutting out gluten completely doesn't fix the problem.
Sometimes, yeah. It can be really frustrating for everyone involved.
I bet.
And to add to that, there are actually two types of RCD, type I and type 2, and they have different characteristics and prognoses.
What's the difference between the two types, and why is it so important to know which one it is?
So in type 1, the IELs look normal, and it often responds to immunosuppressants like steroids or butycinide. But in type 2, you see an abnormal clone of IELs. They have this specific phenotype, CD3 positive and CD8 negative. This is super important because
type 2 is more likely to have complications.
Right.
It really changes how we manage and what we expect for the patient.
Exactly. Type 2 RCD has a much higher risk of developing enteropathy-associated T-cell lymphoma.
EATL. Okay, I definitely need to know more about that. But before we get into lymphoma, can you tell me more about what RCD typically looks like in patients? What should I be looking for?
Well, patients with RCD often have really severe malabsorption.
Mm-hmm.
So think significant weight loss, multiple nutritional deficiencies, and those GI symptoms just stick around, even with the gluten-free diet.
Okay.
They're also at risk for ulcerative jejunalitis, which of course can lead to even more problems.
So it's a really complicated situation clinically.
Yeah.
What are the main ways we manage these different types of RCD?
For type I, prednisolone or butycinide can be really effective for controlling the inflammation. But type 2, that needs a more aggressive approach.
I see.
We often use stronger immunosuppressants like cladribine, and we have to watch really closely for lymphoma.
Okay.
Referral to a hematologist is really important for these cases.
So knowing which type of RCD it is makes a huge difference in how we treat the patient.
Absolutely. It can really change the course of their care and their outcome.
You mentioned EATL earlier. Can we go back to that? What's the risk of lymphoma like for people with celiac disease who aren't being treated?
Mm-hmm.
How worried should we be about this, and what do we need to know?
Untreated celiac disease definitely increases the risk of some types of cancer, and EATL is a big one.
Okay.
It's rare, but it's really aggressive, and it usually affects the jejunum.
That link between RCD type 2 and EATL is especially concerning. What are the usual symptoms of EATL? What should make me think, hold on, this could be EATL?
It can be tough to spot because the symptoms often look a lot like uncontrolled celiac disease. Patients might have abdominal pain. They're losing weight without meaning to. They might have a fever.
Okay.
Sometimes, if it's really bad, the intestine can perforate.
Yikes.
So yeah, early detection is really key here because it's so aggressive.
And you said it's not just EATL, right?
Right. There's also a higher risk of a small bowel adenocarcinoma if someone has celiac disease that's not being managed.
So finding it early and sticking to a gluten-free diet are both super important for preventing these really serious complications.
Exactly. Okay, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about managing celiac disease.
Okay.
We know that avoiding gluten for life is the most important thing, but it's not as simple as just telling patients to cut out gluten, right?
Right. How do we really help them manage this?
That's where a registered dietitian can be so helpful. They can really educate patients about those hidden sources of gluten and the risk of cross-contamination and just how to navigate all the social situations that involve food. Having that support from a dietitian can make a huge difference in whether someone can stick with the diet long term.
It's about giving them the tools to make good choices and handle the challenges of living gluten-free.
Mm.
What about monitoring and follow-up? What do we need to do for patients with celiac disease?
Regular follow-up with their gastroenterologist is really important.
Okay.
We need to track their symptoms, make sure they're not deficient in any nutrients, and check those serological markers every so often to see if they're actually sticking with the diet.
So we're taking a holistic approach,
yeah,
making sure they're avoiding gluten and watching out for any potential complications.
Exactly. And don't forget about nutritional support.
Right.
Some patients will need supplements, especially at first, when they're more likely to have problems with malabsorption.
What kind of deficiencies should we be thinking about?
Those fat-soluble vitamins, A, D, E, and K, they're often low because of the trouble absorbing fat. Iron deficiency is common, we talked about that, and calcium and vitamin D supplements are important to protect their bones.
Okay.
Folate and B12 levels should be checked too.
With all these long-term risks, are there any specific screenings we should do for celiac patients?
We usually recommend bone mineral density scans to check for osteoporosis, especially for older patients or anyone else with risk factors.
Okay.
And we always have to keep an eye out for any signs of malabsorption or anything that could be a sign of malignancy during their follow-up visits.
So we're not just treating what we see right now. We're thinking about their long-term health.
Absolutely. Celiac disease is something they'll be managing their whole lives, and we need to give them the knowledge and the support to really thrive.
Before we move on to some case studies, those are going to really help solidify everything. Can we talk for a minute about differential diagnosis? I know the SCE exam loves to test how well we can think broadly and consider other possibilities.
Absolutely.
So someone comes in with symptoms that sound like celiac disease. What else should be on my differential?
First, think about other things that can cause villus atrophy.
Oh.
So you've got infectious enteropathies like Whipple's disease, giardiasis, or tropical sprue. Those should be on your radar.
Makes sense.
If they've traveled recently, that's a big clue.
Good point. Are there any meds that can cause villus atrophy?
Yeah, some meds can, like NSAIDs and neomycin. They can cause drug-induced enteropathy.
Okay.
So good medication history is really important.
What about autoimmune enteropathy? Where does that fit in?
Autoimmune enteropathy is rare, but it's serious, and it can also cause villus atrophy.
Okay.
We usually diagnose it when someone doesn't get better on a gluten-free diet. It needs some special tests beyond what we normally do for celiac, to be sure.
Sounds like a thorough workup is really important to make sure we're not missing anything else.
Absolutely. The SCE exam wants to know you can think critically and tell the difference between all these conditions.
Okay, I think we've got a good foundation for understanding celiac disease now. Are you ready for some case studies to really bring it all together?
Let's do it. I love a good challenge.
All right, case study number one. A 35-year-old woman comes in. She has a history of chronic iron deficiency anemia. She's tired all the time, and she has these recurring episodes of loose stools. She's tried different iron supplements, but they haven't really helped.
Mm-hmm.
And she also says she has this itchy rash on her elbows and knees that just won't go away. What's at the top of your differential?
Iron deficiency anemia, GI symptoms, and a persistent itchy rash, those together make me think celiac disease right away.
Okay.
That rash sounds a lot like dermatitis herpetiformis, which we know is a strong sign of celiac.
That classic triad of symptoms, right. So what tests would you order to be sure?
I would start with serological testing, so anti-TTG IgA and total IgA levels. And then, of course, a duodenal biopsy is needed to see how much villus atrophy there is and to really confirm the diagnosis.
Let's say her serology is positive and the biopsy shows MARS stage 3A changes. How would you manage her?
The most important thing is a strict gluten-free diet. I'd refer her to a registered dietitian so she can get all the information and support she needs.
Mm-hmm.
I'd also give her iron supplements to correct that deficiency and keep a close eye on her iron levels.
So it's a multi-pronged approach. Get rid of the gluten, treat the deficiencies, mm-hmm. and educate and support the patient.
Exactly. Okay, ready for case study number two?
Hit me.
All right, so we have a 50-year-old man. We know he has celiac disease, diagnosed a few years ago. He's been strictly gluten-free, but he's still having diarrhea and he's losing weight.
Oh.
A repeat biopsy shows that the villus atrophy is still there. What would you do next?
Well, that sounds like refractory celiac disease, RCD. We need to figure out if it's type I or type 2.
Exactly.
I'd want to do immunophenotyping of the intraepithelial lymphocytes to see if there's that abnormal IUL clone, which would mean it's type 2 RCD.
Good thinking.
Yeah.
Let's say the immunophenotyping does confirm type 2 RCD. How would you manage this differently from the first case?
Well, type 2 has that much higher risk of EATL, so I would send him to a hematologist right away. We might need to start immunosuppressive therapy, something like cladribine, but we definitely have to monitor him really closely for lymphoma.
This case really shows how important it is to get the RCD subtype right.
Definitely. Okay, last case study to drive it all home. A 60-year-old woman with celiac disease that hasn't been treated. She comes in with abdominal pain, weight loss, and a fever.
Oh.
Imaging shows a mass in the jejunum. What's your top differential diagnosis?
With that history of untreated celiac disease, the location of the mass, and those symptoms, I'd be most worried about enteropathy-associated T-cell lymphoma, EATL.
This one is a stark reminder of how bad things can get if celiac disease isn't treated.
It really is. Early diagnosis and sticking to that gluten-free diet are so important for preventing these kinds of complications. It's a message we need to get across to all of our celiac patients.
Okay, we've covered a ton of ground today, from the basics of celiac disease to all the different ways it can present, the ins and outs of diagnosis, the challenges of refractory disease, and even the risk of cancer.
We went deep into serological testing, how to do a biopsy properly, and the importance of recognizing those extra intestinal manifestations.
And those visuals we talked about, those would be great reminders.
Absolutely.
Those visuals are super helpful, a great way to really cement these concepts in our minds, especially for the exam.
Totally agree. Sometimes a picture really is worth a thousand words, especially with complex stuff like this.
We've covered so much today, from how celiac disease works at its core to all the different ways it can show up, the details of diagnosis, how to manage it, and even the possibility of it turning into something more serious like cancer.
Yeah, we really dug deep into serological testing, how to get a good biopsy, and why those extra intestinal manifestations are so important.
Right, and we can't forget those visuals we talked about. Those are going to come in handy.
Absolutely, they're great reminders.
This isn't just about memorizing facts for the exam, though, is it?
Nope. It's about understanding how everything connects, being able to use what you know in real-life situations with patients, and ultimately using it to help them get better and live healthier lives.
That makes sense. Any final words of advice for our listeners who are getting ready for the SCE exam?
I'd say remember that the SCE exam is all about testing your clinical reasoning, not just your ability to remember facts. So as you study, try to really understand the why behind the what, you know?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
We can't just know the criteria for diagnosing celiac disease.
Mm-hmm.
We need to understand what's happening in the body, what could go wrong, and why we choose certain treatments.
Exactly. Connect the dots, think critically, don't just take things at face value. They want to see that you can think like a gastroenterologist, not just spit back information.
Great advice. And remember, celiac disease is something people have to manage their whole lives. It's not just about making the diagnosis. We need to be there for our patients, educating them, supporting them, and keeping an eye on things to help them stay healthy.
Couldn't agree more. We have the knowledge and the tools to really make a difference in the lives of people living with celiac disease.
That's a wrap for today's deep dive into celiac disease. We hope this episode was helpful and gave you the knowledge and insights you need to ace the SCE exam and to be amazing gastroenterologists.
Keep those brains working, never stop learning, and always keep striving to give your patients the best care possible.